So as you see the title, it says, The Implications of Hester Panim and Gilui Shechina. Perhaps the first person to really bring or to identify this issue of Hester Panim was Cain, who ironically is also the first person to commit one of the sins which Chazal identify as being one of the really severe sins. In Perek Dalet in Bereshit it says, Vayomer Cain el Hevel Achiv, Vayhi biyotam b'sadeh, Vayakam Cain el Hevel Achiv v'yargehu. He kills his brother. And then the Torah goes on and tells us, Vayomer Hashem el Cain, Ei Hevel Achicha, Vayomer lo yadati, Hashem erachi enochi. There is much to say about this, especially in terms of one of the other reasons which are given for the Chorban, and that is, of course, Sinat Chinam. So the question is, where's your brother? And then, shall we say, the very, very painful answer when he says, Hashomer Achi Anochi, and the answer to that is, of course, yes. You are your brother's keeper. It continues and it says, Va'ata Vayomer Me Asita, Kol Dmei Achicha Tzokim Alei Min Adama. Your brother's blood is screaming. So he is being exiled and to wander. And one of the things that we get later on to the book of Devarim, when it's going to talk about the galut, the exile, one of the elements is going to be this idea of wandering. It's not, meaning that's been our experience. It wasn't simply that we've left the land, it was also that we've been forced to wander over time as well. And that's what he experiences here. But it's his response which I find most interesting. Vayomer Cain el Hashem, Gadol Avonim Inso. So he says, first of all, that the sin is too much, it's too great, and it's as if it sounds like he didn't know the implications. And of course, a good trial lawyer would probably get him off on something, saying there's never been a murder before, there's never been a killing before, perhaps he didn't know what the result's going to be, and why did he think this, and so on. And maybe this whole idea that having a punishment on the books helps as a deterrent, because it seems like he doesn't know what the punishment is, so there is no deterrent, and now suddenly he gets this realization, wow, this is really huge. But then he adds and he says something else. Hein garashta oti hayom me'al pnei adama umi panecha esater. So this hiding, and it's not clear what this actually means, is that I am going to be hidden, is my face hidden from you, or are you hidden from me? I mean, either way, there is obviously a damage in the relationship. It is quite interesting, you know, what exactly it is that he says, and I'll say it again, on some level this reminds us of what we're going to hear moving forward in terms of Hester Panim, but it's interesting that it comes right here in the very first sin, well, sorry, the first murder that takes place. The Radak explains, "Umipanecha astir, shekatzafta alai, v'histarta panecha," he says, because you've been upset with me, and you have hidden yourself from me. And he adds another word, which I really want to pay attention to as well, as we move on, the heshkachatcha mimeni, which means there's going to be a lack of hashkacha, and I don't know how else that we would, maybe we can call this a type of a micromanagement personal relationship with God is going to not be experienced or not be sensed. But that's part of what he expresses over here, is that we're hidden, or I'm hidden, and I'm not going to see you, and I don't sense you. The Bechor Shor similarly says, Shetastir panecha mimeni, that he understands that it's God who's going to be hidden from him, and therefore his being sent away, which in a certain sense does echo the earlier Adam and Eve being kicked out of the garden. Now he is being forced not just out of where he lives, but he's forced to wander. But this other, you know, half a phrase, which I'm not even sure if I would have asked you beforehand, where's the first time you find in the Torah the idea of Hester Panim? I'm not convinced that somebody would have pointed all the way back over here to the sin, because there were so many other things going on over here that we identify with. But nonetheless, that's his experience. And that's really what I think is quite important. It's his experience of the wandering, of the leaving, of this uncertainty. And maybe even the most important word is vulnerability. I'm going to show you in a minute one of the commentaries who essentially reads the Jewish experience to this. And you would say to yourself initially, I mean, what Jewish experience? I mean, this is pre-Matan Torah. It's pre-Avraham. It's pre-Sarah. It's pre-all of those things. So why in the world would we be reading a Jewish experience to this? Well, for obvious reasons, because as we move on in history, we find the Jewish experience is one of going into exile, of wandering, and feeling very vulnerable. And his point here is saying, well, whoever finds you is going to kill me. So I don't know if you've ever even considered that for a moment to say, yeah, that's exactly what we've experienced through so many years of exile and wandering, where Jewish blood was extremely cheap and people never worried about having to pay a price for spilling Jewish blood. So again, I'm not getting carried away yet, because you can all argue with me and say, well, it just doesn't say all of that. But nonetheless, look at Rabbeinu Bachaye in source number 4. Upanecha astir yitachen lefresh mipanecha mimakom shechinatcha. Klomi mimakom shemitraim sham et pnei adom Hashem Elokei Yisrael. So yes, he's reading right into this that I'm going to have to leave a holy place. And then he goes and draws a conclusion that, again, maybe none of us ever would have thought about. That where did he settle? Where did Adam settle once he was kicked out of the Garden of Eden? The best possible place to settle. He settled by Har Moriah. He lived in Jerusalem. But now Cain has to go wander far away from this place and again feel vulnerable. So I'm going to say it again. I find it fascinating how he's reading this into it. Essentially, you've been chased from a place which is holy. And listen what pushes him there. Hin gerashti oti ayom me'al pnei adama hakdusha kidei she'astir mipanecha shekol mi shemitgaresh mimenu nikra nistar mipanav ki hu bereshut Elohim achirim v'chein yizkir David melech olav shalom. But the hiddenness, as I said, it could be he's hidden from God or God is hidden from him. It does that there's an I agree that there's an easier way to read this, but what's interesting is the way that the various Rishonim are reading this in terms of Hester Panim. But even more than that is Rabbeinu Bachaye. I don't want to say gets completely carried away, but I understand what's motivating him. He's saying if there's this hiddenness from God, that means you must have been in a place which is holy. Although, you know, one did not have to say that. But again, what I think is interesting is to the degree that he's reading then the Jewish experience into this thing which he's about to say, look what I've been guilty of. And if I'll go one step further now, just to close this analogy a little bit more. We're going to see very quickly something which we're completely familiar with, and that is this idea that the reason why Galut takes place is because we were guilty of a number of different sins. So over here, the parallel will be then that Cain is guilty of one of these sins that causes Galut to take place. But part of what I'm going to get to is the different aspects of Galut. So if you just go back again to the title, the implications of Hester Panim and Gilui Shechina, and what exactly does this mean? When it's not just a physical, geographical issue. I think that's really the first thing that we need to recognize. It would have been so easy for us to understand, okay, what does it mean to be in Galut? It means that you have gone into Galut and you're geographically distant from Eretz Yisrael. I don't think that is the way that Chazal, or for that matter the Psukim, understand that's what Galut is. It's an aspect of Galut. But as you see right now, the way that Rabbeinu Bachaye is struggling, he understands, no, Kiddush, it's being distanced from something which is holy, which means the holiness is somehow not going to be in this immediate way. And also we saw the word, I'm going to be far away from the Hashkacha, which we're not exactly sure where that entered into this from. Just to review, the Gemara tells us in source number 5, Amr B'Yochan Min Torta, and that starts on Yom Tet Amid Aleph, Mipnei Machor V'Ashilo, and he starts off with Shilo, and then he moves over on Amid Bet to Mikdash Rishon Me'Macharav, Neshloshan Dvarim Shayuba. Avodah Zarah v'Gili Arayot v'Shvichut Amim. And again, all of this we're very familiar with. Aval b'Mikdashenu shiyo oskim b'Torah v'Mitzvot v'Gimlut Chasadim b'Bnei Macharav v'Shaita b'Sinat Chinam. Lamdecha shishkula Sinat Chinam k'neged Shlosha v'Erod Avodah Zarah v'Gili Arayot v'Shvichut Amim. Now, part of what I really want to get to is to understand what exactly Chazal saw when they identified these sins. Because the truth is, there are other sins we could have identified. We're getting close to a Shemitah year, and one of the things that we're going to see as you get close is the best motivation to be extremely machmir is because when the Jews did not keep Shemitah properly, then they were sent into Galut. So, and that is a very, very strong reason to make that claim, because essentially the Chumash does in Parshat Bichukotai. The Bichukotai follows Bahar, again, not just geographically, in terms of substance. And not keeping Shemitah is what brings about an exile, what brings about Galut. So Shemitah is a wonderful category. So why did Chazal nonetheless ignore the obvious written in the Psukim and they move over to something else? And I'm not going to really answer why they avoided that, but I will focus on why these were chosen, because I think there's a very specific reason for them. If we'll start where we started, and that is with murder, the Tosefta, again, the famous story that we're more familiar with, it the way it's quoted in the Gemara. There's a Mishnah, those of you who have gone through more recently Yoma and Daf Yomi, so maybe you're familiar, so I have to be a little more careful, because this is found in the Mishnah, and then there is an extension in the Tosefta. Maaseh b'shnei achim kohanim shiyu shavim v'ratzim. Notice, shnei achim kohanim, achim, which I'm not sure if you noticed in the Gemara. Yeah, so no. So I'm saying that in the Tosefta is quite interesting. Shayu shavim v'ratzim v'olim, and they were running up to up on the altar, on the ramp, v'kadam echad mei, mehen et chaver l'toch arba amot natal tzakin v'taka b'libo. Bo rabbi tzadak v'amar ma'alot ulam bahar habayit. So he comes and he gives a speech. V'omar, shma'uni achinu beit Yisrael, harehu omer kim tzach halal ba'adama asher Hashem l'kecha. And I'm going to skip a little bit because, again, we're used to this, whether this was a real speech in the sense or it was just really to inspire. I mean, what argument that the Gemara concludes he was saying all this just to inspire, but at the end it says, Milamed, well, maybe a little before that, it says, Go kol Yisrael achav bivchia, and everyone started to cry. V'charkach ba aviv shel tinok, the father of the young man sees, v'amar lehem, achenu, ani kapartchem, miparper haya bini, v'sakin lo nitma'at. He's very exciting. He says, no, he's still alive, he's not quite dead, so there's no tum'ah. Milamed shetumat sakin chamura aleim yoter mishvichat damim. And that is, you know, really the terrible conclusion, because we can't imagine any people ever behaving like this, where ritual law would be more important to them than some random interpersonal law. And over here, of course, the random interpersonal law is murder, but nonetheless, the father of the Kohen is far more concerned with the tumah, which is over here. And it continues and it says, V'cheinu omer v'gam naki shafach menashe harbe ma'od mikan omru ba'avon shvichut damim shchina na'alit ubeit hamikdash mitameh. Which means the conclusion over here is quite important in terms of that this kind of murder, and obviously this is an extreme case, a murder taking place in the Beit HaMikdash, a murder taking place when somebody is running to serve God with tunnel vision, which is incredible, but it says, no, that murder is what caused the Shekhinah to go up and to elevate and to withdraw, maybe that's the best word, and to leave the people on their own with their concerns about Tum'ah. And God is essentially saying, I am no longer here, which is, again, it's just such an interesting way of reading what exactly is Galut and what exactly makes the Beit HaMikdash susceptible to destruction and what makes our physical removal from Eretz Yisrael possible. It's when the Shekhinah withdraws and says, you know, I can't stay here anymore. And therefore, when we go back to this first murder and this incredible insight that Cain has in terms of, hold it a second, this is going to cause this lack of my connectedness. I'm going to say it again. That is probably the one element of that story that we never recognized that is staring there, that it's actually the spiritual side of things that he is now suddenly aware of. So now we realize that this is something which the Tosefta has to go and tell us and has to really explain to us why this is so significant. I mean, one more thing about murder, which, you know, unfortunately, one still has to say, the Rambam in source number 7 will tell us a couple of things. First, a technical law in terms of somebody who is a murderer. There's no witnesses. I mean, that's a problem. That's a problem in any legal system when you have no witnesses. Lo yu'adim ro'imoto ke'achad. Ela ru'achad. Achar ha'achad. O sharag b'vnei shnei idim below hatra'a. Again, technically there was no warning over here. O shahu chashua idim b'vdikot v'lo chashu b'chakirot. They were somehow, they were discounted as witnesses. Kol elu haratzchanim. What do we do with all of these murderers who we really know they're murderers, but they get off on a technicality? Konsim otam lekipa. We put them in a prison. Uma'achilim oto lechem tsar. It's probably matzah. We give them some very difficult kind of bread. Umayim. Lachatz ad sheyatzaru me'ehim. Va'achakach ma'alim oto se'arin ad shetibaka kersum mikovid hacholi. We food poison them until they die. Which you say, hold it a second. I mean, what happened to all the arba mitot beit din and so on? Yeah. But over here, they got off on a technicality. And then the Torah says, sorry, the Rambam says, he adds, ve'ein osin davar ze l'shar mechuyevei mitat beit din. We don't do this when it comes to all other types of people that were guilty of various crimes, even if there was a death penalty involved in it. Aval im nitchayv mita mamitin oto v'im einu chayav mita poltrin oto. Sha'af apish yesh avonot chamurin mishfichat damim. Even though there are some sins which are more severe than shfichut damim, ein behem hashchatat yishuvo shel ulam kishfichut damim. There's no sin which is as societally damaging as this sin. This is the most profound sin societally. And of course, before we go on to next, you know why the Rambam compared it with those other two, because those are going to be our three favorite Aveirot. And then he continues then to say, or Chilul Shabbat, Einu Kishvichat Tamim. She'elu Avonot Heimei Aveirot Shebein Adam L'Makom. Avol Shvichut Tamim Me Aveirot Shebeino L'Bein Chaveiro. V'kol Mi She'yesh Biyado Avon Zeh, anybody who took a life is completely wicked. And all the good deeds he may have done is not going to help him with this sin. And then he goes on and tells us some more about this. Yeah, that was interesting. He says that. It's not the only place he says it. It's also in Hilchot Tshuvah he says that. But to understand, again, a little bit more about why this is so severe, and what interests me, again, is about murder itself and why this causes the Shechina to recoil or to withdraw, maybe we should note the Pasuk in Parshat Noach in Source 8. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech ki b'tzelem elokim asat adam. That the implication of man being created in the image of God is that by killing something, you somehow have decreased divinity in this world. Which means as much as we want to make a distinction between adam l'makom and adam l'chaveiro, part of the problem with killing someone, which is adam l'chaveiro, is that you have somehow damaged something which God has invested in a sense of creating the Tzelem Elohim, and that particular Tzelem Elohim is no longer here. You have eradicated that particular Tzelem Elohim, which means that manifestation of something godly, of that particular neshama, if you will, that is completely gone, and therefore that is considered to be something where maybe we shouldn't be as surprised that the Shekhinah withdraws, because you've caused the Shekhinah to leave by virtue of killing somebody who is B'Tselem Elohim. If we'll just quickly move on to the other two, and again, I'm more interested right now in the biblical discussion than I am in the Gemara. And what I mean by that is, we saw the Gemara. The Gemara says that these are the three sins that cause the Korban. But where do you get it from in terms of the Torah? So again, very quick, source number 9. Where we have in Perek Yudched and Achrimot, one of the list of all the Arayot. And at the very end it says, in Pasuk Kafhe, v'titma ha'aretz, v'efkod avona alev, v'takei ha'aretz et yoshveha. People guilty of Gilei Arayot causes the land of Israel, which has this sensitive constitution, simply to expel this type of behavior. Again, it says a couple of verses later, ki et kol ha'tevot ha'el asu anshei ha'aretz, asher lefneichem, v'titma ha'aretz. Again, the land will vomit this out in source number 10 in Parakaf. the same thing is done. Again, the list of Ariyot are repeated, and over here it says, "Ushmartem et kol chukotai v'et kol mishpatai v'asit matam v'lo takiyatchem ha'aretz asher ani mivichem shama l'shevet pa." So I can understand very well why Chazal are saying, "Well, look at these particular sins, because you know one is a direct affront to the Shechina, to Tzem L'Elokim, and therefore to God who created man in His image, and the other one is a sin of God creates holiness within the land, and therefore a sin within this land creates the situation where we are forced to be expelled." In source number 12, we have a midrash. This midrash is in a couple of different places. And I'm actually going to come back in a moment to Avodah Zarah, but first I want to identify something. You know what? Fine. Let's do the order I put it here. In source number 11, we have the sin of Avodah Zarah. And I hope you recognize there were probably 100 different verses I could have chosen to express this idea. So this is towards the end of Devarim. And the reason this is here, is you'll see very quickly, is because we also have the Hester Panim over here. V'yar Hashem bo ma'od anan v'yamod amud ha'anan al petach o'el. V'yomar Hashem Moshe, hinei shochev im avotecha, which means that he is about to pass away. V'kama amaze v'zana acharei Elohei necher, which means, it's interesting, but Avodah Zarah is actually a breach of the covenant. And one of the things that we've seen a number of times is this midrash that Rashi quotes in Shir HaShirim. If you take the Aseret HaDibrot and line them up 5 and 5, so then you have not worshipping other gods directly parallel with not committing adultery. Which means, and there's a lot to that midrash. It means that that's the one which is breaking the covenant. That's the one which is, and also vizana. So you also have this language of znut, vizana, acharei Elohim acharim. And therefore, that's the one where serving other gods is breaking this relationship, this loving relationship of God, who is this knight in shining armor who then carries out the Jewish people who are the damsel in distress and carries us out of Egypt. And then it says, but if you're guilty of Avodah Zarah, that's going to sever that relationship. Right? That's where we see Hester Panim, and coming again in Pasuk Yudchet, Vanochi astir panai b'yomahu al kol ra'a she'asa ki pana el Elohim achirim. So again, just looking at these three sins, and these are the three sins which are the main three sins, and these are three sins that cause some kind of a severing of the relationship with God. And it's interesting, because the three that I pointed out all work with a slightly different dynamic. It's not a generic, oh, these three are one. They're really very different. The sin of Avodah Zarah is one of a direct affront in the relationship, although the sin of murder is a very different affront. Which means it rejected something else, while the sin of Gilui Arayot did something else. Which means that sounded much more that you were living in a way that that the land can't tolerate this. On the other hand, the sin of murder is something which is so profoundly wrong in terms of the interpersonal relationships, so therefore this is now going to be a society which just can't possibly tolerate such a thing, because again, it is an affront to God. So I just want to move over for a second now to the other sin, the one which is more associated with Bayit Sheni, and that is the sin of sinat chinam. So notice source number 12. What it says is as follows. This is right when Moshe gets the commandment to actually build the Mishkan. Amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Rabbi Simon, Yoshev b'seter hu elyon al kol b'yotav. And we're going to skip a little bit. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo kishem shatas savor, kach ani savor. The way this midrash is explained in other places, which are a little bit broader, it says that when God tells Moshe to build the Mishkan, Moshe is in complete shock. What do you mean to build a Mishkan? What do you mean to build a house for God? God is transcendent, and God cannot be contained in a building, and God is outside of time, space, and matter. The very thought of creating it is a total absurdity. So God says it's not what you think. And coming now back in the language of the Mishkan, Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu, Lo kashem shata savor kach ani savor, Ela esrim keresh b'tzafon ve'esrim b'darom v'shmona b'marav, V'lo od ela she'ered v'atzamtzem shchinati b'toch ama al ama. I will come down and I will somehow contract my existence into an area which is only, shall we say, one amma upon one amma. So we need to understand this. As much as later on the teachings of the Arizal included this concept of tzimtzum, which is a very popular Kabbalistic term, and tzimtzum generally in the Arizal's thought is something which relates to creation. And it's actually, and this is the way that I want to make sure that we understand it, it's the price to be paid on God's part for creation, which means we never even think about God's part in creation. Creation for God is a sacrifice. And you're saying, what do you mean it's a sacrifice? Now God has all these people. Well, first of all, having all these people sometimes is not what we think it is. But that's not the point. Prior to creation, if we can even use that word for something which transcends time, prior to creation, there was only God. And God's unity and indivisibility and uniqueness, and I don't know what other word to use because our language is somewhat limited. It's God is. That's probably the best way to finish that. God is. There's nothing else. God is. But then with creation, there is another. There is other. There is place. There is time. There is matter. And some of the other that God creates is actually us. And then we can walk around and then we can have our doubts about God. Can you imagine how God is in this absolute reality of creation, but before creation there's only God and there is no other reality, and he creates us, and then there are those of us who not only walk around with doubts, but we choose not to listen, and sometimes we choose to do these incredible things, and God is sitting there watching, but the only reality which exists is the divine, and you're sitting there questioning reality. Rabbi Soloveitchik once expressed this in terms of the absurd mathematical calculation that there is an infinite God who creates a finite world, and therefore infinite plus finite remains infinite. Although there's another mathematical solution that infinite plus finite is also infinite plus finite. But nonetheless, the reality is one of infinity, and therefore the creating the finite world is not something which impinges on the infinity, but part of what the question is philosophically, how does an infinite God create this finite world? And the answer then is by holding back and creating space and creating coexistence, and therefore allowing this other thing to live within infinity, and I'm going to say it again, and then not listen to the infinite God and question the infinite God, and so on and so forth. So the way that creation is understood Kabbalistically is some kind of a sacrifice on God's part, because now there is a theological absurdity which exists. And the theological absurdity is people walking around with not listening to God, not believing in God, not consulting God, or not having a God consciousness at all, and that is understood as being an absurdity. Now, that whole discussion, which is more of this Kabbalistic Arizal discussion, now we realize, based on what we just now saw, actually has its source going all the way back to the building of the Mishkan. So God says, build a Mishkan, and Moshe's response is, but you're transcendent. How can a transcendent God be in one place? And God says, I will make a sacrifice. I will perform this gesture of tzimtzum. I will somehow limit myself to... Just one more second. I'll somehow limit myself to this one place in time, as it were. And that itself, what we need to understand in terms of an infinite God, which Moshe understands as being completely outside of time, space, and matter. How are you here? What are you talking about? Which means it's almost dangerously Avodah Zarah-like to say a God is in one particular place, in one particular time. But that's not the issue. Moshe's bothered by the impossibility of this. And God says, I'm going to perform self-sacrifice, as it were, and I am going to mitzamtzem the Shekhinah to one particular place. Of course, that's the exact parallel. And therefore, both of these are parallel gestures by God, the creation on the one hand, and then creating the Mishkan on the other hand, and then having the Shekhinah there. But what I want to point out, and I hope that wasn't too much philosophically, but I'm much more interested in the philosophical implications than I am in the mathematical calculations. The man, let's just think for a moment now. We're told that the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. Sinat Chinam means I couldn't practice self-control. So now just think for a second about the implications of what I just now said. Is that the whole Mishkan is God practicing self-control and self-limitation, and then we are walking around as human beings feeling that we have no need at all to ever practice self-limitation. We rather often get into this how dare you mode to somebody else, and you've impinged upon my honor or my perceived honor or my feelings or something else, and then this anger and hatred and somehow follows without thinking for a moment that the very creation is based upon God's self-limitation, and therefore by extension our creation and our having a tzelem elokim is all based upon this idea that God was willing or able to somehow to limit itself, and then going on to the Beit HaMikdash itself, to creating the Shekhinah in a sense of a holy place, is based upon God's self-limitation. And so therefore, I'm going to say it again, the philosophical implication of all this is far more interesting to me, because what it then points to, that when we can't practice this own our own self-control, self-limitation, and so on, then of course we have just now essentially begged God, please destroy the Beit HaMikdash, because we are undeserving of having a place like this. We're undeserving of your gesture, because we're not willing to follow with a likewise gesture. So again, if we're able to wrap our minds around that, I think that we're just now able to understand that it's not just some kind of random thing. Oh, like again, murder that somehow causes a separation from God. Yes, you've rejected a tzel elokim in that person who's essentially irreplaceable. That human being will never come back. What that human being could have done, one of the things that Chazal say is that demei achicha, the bloods, right? Not a gang in L.A., the bloods. The demei achicha is all the generations of children and grandchildren and so on who will never come into this world you have murdered. You have just destroyed, again, that's where it comes from, whoever kills one person, as if they have killed an entire world, destroyed an entire world. You don't, but it's more than that, that you've killed all these people. There was going to be a unique tzelem elokim and contribution that each and every one of those people could have done, and you have now completely frustrated, murdered that possibility. So that goes back to what Chazal understood. Again, when it goes to Gilei Ariyot, you see the verses. No, the land is holy. The land cannot tolerate this kind of behavior. When it comes to idolatry, that impinges the relationship with God, and that's cheating on God, as it were, and that just severs that kind of relationship. And finally, when we got to the second Beit HaMikdash, hold it, why is Sinat Chinam so wrong? Why is this so bad? Well, think about it. We are unwilling to do that which God did in terms of creation on the one hand, and the Mishkan on the other hand. And therefore, in a sense, what we've done over here is that we have challenged the very possibility of there being a Mishkan. And by the way, now the question you can ask me, haven't we just now challenged creation? And the answer is yes. So therefore, now you can begin to understand that God only destroys the Beit HaMikdash and doesn't destroy creation when we misbehave is itself an act of kindness that probably we never would have considered until this point. Let's try to... I understand. Nonetheless, I think it's attitudinal, and it starts off in terms of how we raise ourselves and others, and how much we feel in a sense of entitlement. And when you begin to have this more limited sense of entitlement and more of a developed sense of the other, then this all would make a little more sense. And then, of course, it goes to this idea of the holy. I think that's what it spills over to, but I think that we sometimes just ignore the idea of the holy. Okay. In Source 13, though, one more element is introduced that I want to get to, and that's the second part, really, of the title, the implications. When it's describing the galut in Sefer Dvarim, one of the things it says, "Yidche Hashem b'shigaon," and there's another verse of it, "You will become mishuga, you will become crazy." That's to me incredibly important. "Uv'ivarun ron uv'timhon levav." The translation, if you like it or not, Hashem will strike you with madness, with blindness, with astonishment of the heart. I don't think astonishment of the heart is good enough. Timhom Levav is I think it's much more a sense of confusion. I think it's much more confusion than it is astonishment. It's that we will walk around with a state of confusion. If we go back to that first sin in the Garden of Eden, when Eve and then Adam eat from the fruit, and as much as it is a fruit of knowledge, of tree of knowledge of good and evil, the result, nonetheless, is the result going to be knowledge or one of confusion? And of course, one of the things that we've noted over the years is that it's a tree of knowledge of good and evil. It's not just a tree of knowledge. And sometimes when you ingest good and evil together, you end up with a confusion between good and evil. Immediately afterwards, what we find is that vatipakchena eneshnehem, both of their eyes open up, v'yedu, so now they have the knowledge, v'yedu ki erumimhem. And now they know, so that this is the knowledge, so they know about nakedness, which of course we have to wonder and what implications are that in terms of the later sins of nakedness. But this is something which they now have a sensitivity to. And they go and they make flimsy clothing, cover themselves up. V'yishmu'ot kol Hashem Elokim etaleich bagan. And they hear the sound of God. And one of the things which is interesting is both Hashem and Elokim, midat rachamim and midat din, God's sense of compassion and sense of judgment. Mitalech bagan l'ruach hayom, v'yitchabe ha'adam v'ishto. And they hide. And that's part of the tragic result of sin, is again, as much as we saw later on, Cain understanding, this is going to cause hester panim. You have Hester Panim taking place right now, but the Hester Panim is coming place on man's side, even though remarkably there was a sin, and God is engaging Adam in conversation. And we all know that what Adam could have done, because you always wonder what is original sin, as it were, what Adam could have done is saying, I'm sorry, I messed up. I did something I shouldn't have done. We don't know how the world continues if Adam would have said that. And over here, especially when God asks him, right, and asks him a question that maybe sounds very similar to a question that we hear today, and he says the words Ayeka. At least one of the commentaries in the Midrash sees the similarity between Ayeka and Echa. Ayeka, you know, where are you? Which means you have become distanced from me, and that's part of what confusion and sin does. And that's part of the reason why this is so interesting in terms of the confusion and the madness. Maybe Mishugah is better, madness is better than any other translation. We suffer from something, and we suffer from confusion. And over here, Adam and Eve, I think, having that same bout with confusion, perhaps madness, and right now, what do you do, and how do you approach, and how do you talk? But most importantly, what they're also noting is this separation, which has now taken place, but the separation is taking place on their part, because now they've covered themselves up, and they're trying to hide from God. And when we keep in mind later on, again, including, you know, their son, and then moving all the way over to the description in Devarim, where sin causes Hester Panim, where it causes God to hide. And God says, I will hide my face on that day. So that, again, becomes, I think, extremely interesting. Now, one of the places that this gets played out, and maybe we don't give this enough attention today, is, and I say today specifically on Tisha B'Av, because it just seems to be part of something else, but it's not. I mean, one of the things that the Shiva Subatam was in Tisha B'Av are about the sin of the golden calf leading over to the sin of the spies. Those are the two major sins of Am Yisrael. If you go to the Mishnah in Ta'anit, it says, oh, five things happened on Shiva Subatamas and five things happened on Tisha B'Av. And these are the beginning of the serious or severe problems that we end up experiencing. But one of the things that happens afterwards is, and this is just very difficult to understand. Maybe that's why we don't study it enough. In Source 15, this is Perek Lamed Gimel, in Shemot, v'diber Hashem el Moshe panim el panim. So God talked to him face to face. Now, panim v'panim, we don't even know what that means, but although the text continues and says, kashe yideber isha reyehu. So God speaks to him, and everything sounds great until we get to the next pasuk. V'yom Moshe el Hashem, re'e ata omer elai ha'al et ha'am hazeh, because you told me to go and to take them and so on. And then in Yud Gimli says, v'ata im namatzati chen beinecha, Hodi einina et drachecha. That's interesting. Inform me of your paths, if you will. Ve'edacha lemanem tzachin beinecha. Ureiki amcha ha'goy hazeh. We're not sure what it is that he wants. Ve'yom ha'panai yilchu v'anichoti lach. Ve'yom ha'ilavim ein panecha hochim. And he keeps coming back to the panai and the panecha. And finally he says, Ve'mei yivada eifo ki matzati chen beinecha aniva amecha. And I'm going to say it again, as we're reading this, we're not exactly sure what he wants. V'yomar, Vayomer ani avir kol tuvi al panecha, vekarati b'shem lefanecha, vechanoti et asher achon, v'richamti asher arachem. Vayomer lo tuchal lerot et panai, ki lo yirani adam v'chai. Even though a moment ago we were told that he spoke to him face to face. Vayomer shehini makom iti v'nitzavta al atzur. Vayaba vur kvodi v'samti b'nikrat atzur v'sakoti kapai alecha ad avri, so I will readily admit that I understand this at least as poorly as most of you do, maybe even less. I don't know what I'm reading. Yeah, well, we can translate the words if you want. We don't know exactly as what he has asked for. We don't know exactly what the response is. We don't know how this... But one thing that we do see is that this idea of Hester Panim, I'm saying this in the most... you know, broad way possible, this thing which we would call Hester Panim, Moshe is seemed to fight against it. You know, if we'll go back to the beginning then, that the sin of the golden calf, which is a sin of Avodah Zarah, which is one which challenges the relationship between God and the Jewish people and can cause this divine divorce and separation to take place, nonetheless, Moshe now is responding and saying, no, but please, let's rekindle the relationship. Let's try to fix everything, and maybe even more than that, than just fixing things. Let there be spiritual intimacy between God and the Jewish people. And I'll say it again, I don't even know how to translate these words into English, but it really goes back, as much as the Hester Panim is introduced afterwards, over here what Moshe seems very much to be asking for is Gilui Panim, please. And then God answers in a way that we don't know what to do with the answer. He says, no, I really can't do that, but I will show you, and you can pass by, and then you'll see. You'll only see afterwards. You won't see before. And I'm just saying, as we read this, I hope that all of you understand that it's not as simple as maybe we all think it is. So again, if all of you understand it perfectly, then wonderful. But I want to now try to read this again. What I really want to use as the framework, you know, to try to understand this, is an argument of the Gemara in Brachot in Source 16. There are two different approaches there. We'll start with the first one. Amar Yochim Mishon Biosi. Shlosha Devarim Bikesh Moshe Fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Natan Lo. Moshe had three requests, and God granted them. If you want, we can read all of the requests. One of the ones, Bikesh Yitzhra Shechina Yisrael, that he wanted the Shechina to be on the Jewish people, v'natan lo, and so on. Because shelo tishra Shechina al dei kochavim, v'natan lo, and he requested that the Shechina not be upon idolaters. Because lo dia drachav shel kadosh baruch hu, v'natan lo, and he asked him to reveal. And that was the word we saw before of the path. Explain your path. Explain your ways. So, in order to best understand this, let's just look at the other opinion, which is a little lower down. Upligid Rav Meir, but the argument is with Rav Meir. Damur of Meir, Shtaim Natnulo, Vachat Lo Natnulo. He gave him two, he didn't give him the third. And what was the third? It says, Lo Tuchalo Ot Panai. Now, what I skipped in between the first and the second is the Gemara's understanding exactly what it was that he wanted. What it wasn't when he said, Hadi'ini Nadrachecha, Amalafer Vibonu Shalom Neima, Yesh Tzadik Vitovlo, Vish Tzadik Viralo, Yesh Rasha Vitovlo, Vish Rasha Viralo. Why is this world being managed in a way that we human beings who would like to believe we're decent people, we look at things that take place and we have no understanding at all of the decisions that God made? And what's the machloket between Rabbi Yossi and between Rav Meir? Whether God granted Moshe the understanding of how God runs the world or not. That was Reino Drachecha. Let me know your path. Let me know the rules. Let me know exactly what you're doing. What's behind the scenes over here? And according to the first opinion, yes, Moshe understood all of this. And according to the other one, Moshe didn't understand it. So anytime somebody tries to explain why bad things happen to good people and all kinds of things like this, so just realize that there is at least an opinion, and maybe even the dominant, and maybe the conclusion of the Gemara is that even Moshe Rabbeinu, who had a very good relationship with God, who God essentially says, okay, make three wishes, and I'll give you two of them, right? And he doesn't reveal this to him. That this is something which Moshe doesn't know. And I think that this actually has levels to it. And this is, I think, what we need to also understand. When it comes down to the difference between sin, separation from God, a relationship with God, and hashkacha, there is a inner working here, which again, I'm not explaining at all why bad things happen to good people, but I'm explaining a slightly different dynamic. Because part of this whole thing is actually the issue of the exile, of the churban, of the galut, of wandering around, of walking around crazy, walking around as mad people, walking around with a total lack of understanding, walking around with confusion. There's a couple of different places that I would look in order to explain this concept. But first, let me just... Because part of what I'm doing is a little bit dangerous, because there's one more factor involved. And that factor is that we have Beit HaMikdash, Galut. Eretz Yisrael, Galut. We have Zman HaZeh, we have the coming epic. And we have confusion between all of those, because none of the things I just now said are, you know, completely absolute. Because, for example, right now we're in Eretz Yisrael, but at least a lot of us, but we don't have the Mikdash. So therefore something is missing, but nonetheless there's something is here. And it's this sensitivity to these issues that I wanted to try to identify. First, I want to do the most basic one, following the Gemara that we just now saw. There's a Gemara in Psachim, source 17. And the day is going to come, quoting the verse, that on that day God will be one and his name will be gone. And of course the Gemara finds that to be very problematic. By the way, all of us now know that's part of the price for creation. Before creation, yeah, everyone knew that God is one and his name is one. Why? Because there was no one else. And so therefore there was nothing impinging upon the absolute knowledge of God. So therefore now the price to be paid for creation and the price to be paid for a world of sin is this world where a verse has to say this unbelievably, almost unbelievable statement that there's going to become a time when the Gemara now asks, Atu ha'idna lav echadhu? Are you saying that today God isn't one? Amar Rabbi Acha bar Chanina, lo kol olam hazeh olam haba. Ha'olam hazeh b'sor tovot omer baruch atov ha'meitiv. Today, when good things happen, you win the lottery. I mean, if any of you are going to win the lottery, you have to know what bracha to make. Or I guess in the high tech world, it's an exit. You have an exit, right? It's not galut. That's a different kind of exit. So you have to know what bracha you say. You say baruch atov ha'meitiv. So it says for good things we say baruch atov ha'meitiv. Va'al b'sarot ra'ot, and God forbid bad things happen, omer baruch dayan ha'met. Now baruch dayan ha'met is a statement that I don't know why this happened, and I'm sure that God is a fair judge, and I sit here in my confusion, and I take a leap of faith that everything here was really okay. La'olam haba, and this is really the remarkable statement. La'olam haba, and I don't know when that is, la'olam haba. But in a future existence, kulo hatov ha'metiv, that at some point everything will be perceived as a tov ha'meitiv, and I'm going to spend the rest of the time trying to explain this point. Going back to a simpler level of this, in source 18, the Gemara says, the land of Israel is a land, Eretz Asher, Hashem Elokecha Doreish Ota Tamid Einei Hashem Elecha Ba, Merishit Hashana V'ad Acharit Hashana. It's a land which has God micromanaging in a way which is unlike outside, which means here is a place. Again, I'm not here talking about those bigger issues. I'm talking about what Hester Panim O Gilui Panim is. Hester Panim is where God is hidden. But in the land of Israel, there is more of an open relationship where God is not distanced from the land. Quite the opposite. God is micromanaging the land. In Shir HaShirim, there's a pasuk that says, Kol dodi hinei zabam delega laharim akabetz al gvaot domed dodi litzfi ola ofer ha'ayalim hinei za omed achar kotlenu mashkiach minachalonot mitzitz miharakim. There is God watching. That's again that word we saw in the beginning, hashkacha. God is watching from the windows, peeking through the cracks of the, what's that word for the lattices? That's the word. So I saw once, and I spent most of my time preparing for this year looking for this one source that I didn't find. And that is, I saw once a comment of the Vilna Gaon saying that there's two kinds of ways that God runs the world. in the land of Israel, God is standing right outside the window and looking in the window. When you look out the window, you can see God. All of us can look out our windows, and we see God over here who's running the world and all the plants and all the things growing and all this miracle that we live in, the desert bloom, and you can keep on going. And then there is the relationship between God and the Jewish people and God and the world outside of the land, where you look out the window, you don't necessarily see anything because God is only peeking through the lattices. That means that the level of hashkacha, this is really continuing on the verse before where the eyes of God are on the land, that outside there's this much lower level of direct micromanagement which is taking place. It's actually the way that things are run because, again, that's what I'm saying, it's connected to the previous verse where there God is actually micromanaging all the time, and other things are taking place in terms of chutz la'aretz. So there is more of a fleeting, peaking feeling that maybe every now and again you get this creepy feeling somebody's looking in through the someplace through the lattice of the window. But they say that's really the difference of that's the way the Vilna Gaon explained this verse. It is perhaps of interest that the first part that said omed al kotleinu, that the midrash. This is one of the very few times that this phrase comes in rabbinic literature. Rav Yosef b'Chanina la'arzila da'ayelata hineza omer achar kotleinu ze kotel hamaravi shabeta mikdash she'inu chorev l'olam lama sheshchina b'mariv mashkiach min achalonot b'zchut avot. The harim are very often understood as avot, and the gvahot are very often understood as the imahot. Mitzitz min acharakim b'zchut imahot k'shem sheyesh shafresh ben chalon l'chrach kach yesh shafresh ben zchut avot l'zchut imahot, which seems to be, again, I understood this from the Vilna Gaon, but I think once I know this, I can read this in, is that, when the father sometimes takes care of the child, he's there in a very obvious way, but the mother can never take her eyes off the child. And even though you don't feel the mother there, she's still peeking in through the crevices, and therefore there is this other relationship, and therefore it says over here very specifically, Zchut Avot and Zchut Imahot are not the same. The Zchut Imahot is even often Galut, God is still there as a mother, and by the way, that's actually the meaning that we go into Galut, the Shekhinah goes with us, and that is in a certain sense God as a mother, but nonetheless, it's a slightly different relationship as in the land of Israel, where things are much more obvious. Which all leads me to Source 21. Now, the funny thing about Source 21 is I've seen in the last 2 days, 5 different people quote little pieces of this, and my brother assured me that this is the best version of it. It was a speech that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave in 1968. I don't know if he gave it in Yiddish or in English. I don't know what to say. But he told me that he listened to it very carefully and he wrote down every single word. And this is how he said it. Now realize this is Tammuz 7-7, 1968. Some of us may know that right before 1968 was 1967. And one of the questions that people will ask today as well, why exactly do we need Tisha B'Av? Could be in the last year when we realize that there's still such things as biblical types of plagues around, that maybe we realize that maybe we need something. But responding to this voice that maybe we just don't need Tisha B'Av anymore, Rabbi Soloveitchik, I think, speaks to the very heart of the issue. And then I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to try to show the sources that he doesn't quote, because he very often didn't quote sources. You know why? Because he was wrote by Soloveitchik. He didn't have to quote sources. If he said something, that was enough. But when he spoke, I'm not being flippant. When he spoke, it was the weight of all of Torah and deep understanding which was coming out. But listen to what he says about why still commemorate Tisha B'Av. Im kol ha'tzlacha she'ta b'tkufat ha'bayit sheni. With all of the success that existed in Bayit Sheni, lo niftura baya b'sisit achad. There was one problem that wasn't solved. Habayit Sheni lo hiva ma'aneu pitaron lebaya ha'machshavatit shematzig sefer Eicha. He says that the building of the second Beit HaMikdash did not answer any of the questions from Eicha. She'la ha'omedit me'acharei tof'at ha'chorban. The question that stands behind the very essence of the destruction. Oto bayak duma shel tzadik v'ralav v'rashavatov lo. Now you see what we're back there. Why bad things happen to good people. Which means all the pain and all the suffering, all the destruction that took place, and all those horrific things which are so difficult to read in Midrash Eicha and then in the keynote, he's saying, and how exactly does the building of the second Beit HaMikdash answer any of those questions that were put up? HaMikdash Hushmad Nashim Unu V'Nitma'u. He says, the temple was destroyed, women were abused and defiled, Nevi'im v'kohen nirtzachu, prophets and kohanim were murdered, v'kol eilei yedei am tamei v'achsari, and all of this was done by this primitive, impure, ruthless, evil nation. Hashe'la nishara stuma v'ko'evet k'shaita. The question remains as impenetrable, as painful as it was. Without any kind of solution, even after the second temple was built. All those difficult questions that we asked in Eicha all remained exactly as they were right after the Churban. That these screams to God, they stood like unanswered. Chanukat Abayit Hasheni, Kinot Yirmiyo, Mita'arot Et HaGoral, HaTragi Shel Am Yisrael, Biyato Matara, Lachatzei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Tmihot Eilu Nashirot Stumot Shiyu, Ve'ein Poterotan. That all the questions that tormented people, none of them were answered. Bishat Yisod Abayit Hasheni, Kasher Tzi'irei Ha'am, Mitoch Chusser Rikshut. And when the second temple was built, the young people, with a total lack of sensitivity, Sharu Hilalu Vishtalalu Meirov Simcha. They celebrated with this incredible joy. Hayu Levim Shurim Bitsar Shenavo Meoto Ba'ayas Tumah Shel Eicha Lamrot Shnei Shivat Zion Hitkashem. Nonetheless, there were people, Levim, who were still there in pain despite the dream coming true of the return to Zion. V'yisdu Aponim Et Eicha L'Hashem, and they built, and this is now quoting from Ezra. And it describes how they celebrated and they sang the Psalms of David. And many of the people who remembered the first temple, they cried terribly. And the way I always understood this, till reading this now, was that the reason they cried was the comparison. The second Beit HaMikdash paled in comparison. It didn't have the same kind of holiness as the first temple. And by the way, I will note that one of the things the first temple all had that's missing is the Urim V'Tumim, which does also answer all kinds of questions. One of the things that we had there was a Navi who answers all kinds of questions. When I mentioned earlier the confusion and the madness that takes place, part of the madness that takes place is because we don't have answers to questions. We don't understand why things are happening. We don't have anyone to ask. And the answers which were given are more often than not completely subjective and, shall we say, inappropriate. It can't possibly be that every single problem in the history of the world is because women's skirts are not long enough, or depending your ass, because they wear shaitels, or someone else because they don't wear shaitels. And then that is the entire world goes around these particular things. It's that's exactly the problem with the galut, is that we don't know. We walk around in confusion. We walk around without knowing answers to the questions. And that is precisely what Rabbi Soloveitchik over here is identifying. And it says, and the elders who remembered the first temple, and he's reading it, and they remember all the pain and all the questions which are unanswered. And now, even though you have a temple, those questions are still unanswered. The elders remembered the destruction. They remembered how thousands and tens of thousands of Jews were killed and their blood was spilled in the streets. They hadn't forgotten the destruction of the land. They were still asking Eicha. They were still asking, you know, how did all of this happen? Why did all of this happen? And again, if we're not getting this yet, he's saying all this in 1968. We have to be very, very thankful for what we have. But there are still questions that we don't know the answers to. He continues, and he'll spell it out very, very clearly in a moment. And he says, we need to be thankful for everything that we have because we are in this very confusing time right now, which is Bein HaShmashot before Shabbat. and Bein Hashmashot, you know, we want to start Shabbat earlier, but you're still during the week and it's not yet Shabbat, and that's what the Tchalta de Geula is. And it is a time of an irbuvia, of a confusion between two different moments. And he says that even though we need to be thankful, Ach in chiyuv zeh kedei leftor tshilat Eicha, but our thankfulness does not answer Eicha. And when that first Tisha B'Av came, after they built the second Beit HaMikdash, they still once again said kinot, because they still had the question, Eicha. Despite everything that we had to be thankful for, just in case he thought that we were imagining what he's about to say, Ha'im Yom Atzma'ut Oneo Sheilat Eicha, did Yom HaTzmaut answer that question? Rak tipshim yicholim lachshov kach. Tipshim shachtsanim v'yesh harbei tipshim ke'ele. Ha'im memshalat yehudit o tzlachat tzvait him tzmora l'sevil, l'kol ha'sevil v'herig shel shnot ha'galut? Is the fact that we have a country, does that answer all the questions of what our people have been through? Asur lomar, and he said, one is forbidden to say, shezeo mechir shel sheshet milyonei yehudim shenitbachu. One is not permitted to say that the price we paid to get our freedom was 6 million souls who were slaughtered. Zebitui la'achsariyut v'chose rikshut totali. Anybody who says that, it's an expression of cruelty and absolute insensitivity. Amnan salat ha'nitzachon she'mechamed sheshet yamim ona kol she'lot she'taru b'tkuvat she'kadmala? Does the victory of the Six-Day War answer all the questions of the Holocaust? Are we still left with some questions? Was that enough to make us completely spiritually complacent? Is that enough to solve all of our problems and all of our questions? Do we still have to ask that question of Eicha? As long as God's behavior and will is hinin, as it was during that whole dark night when God was hidden, the whole time that we still don't have an understanding of all of these historical events that had taken place, a true understanding. As long as the nations of the world, they still ridicule us. And our belief in a God who's compassionate and kind. Until we found the solution of Eicha, asul lentosha Tisha B'Av. We can't leave Tisha B'Av behind until we have an answer to all of the questions that were put out and all those questions which exist. So I think it's quite clear the direction that he's going in over here. And he ends up saying, yeah, there will come a time that the fast day of the fifth month, Tisha B'Av, will become a day of celebration but that's only going to take place in the Messianic Age. But the reason for that is what I still have to explain. Because as you noted, he brought no sources whatsoever. He made a declaration. And we'll start perhaps we saw one explanation, and that was the Gemara that we saw before. That the day will come that we'll be able to say Hatova Hametiv to everything. We'll be able to say that. Source 22 is one of the sources that speak about the Messianic Age. V'yatzach choter migezi Yishai. A descendant of Yishai is going to arise. V'nachalav ruach Hashem, ruach chachma uvina, ruach etzag vura. And one of the things that it says that will happen then is kol ha'aretz will get filled up. Ki mala'a ha'aretz de'a et Hashem. That knowledge of God will completely fill the world. Knowledge of God does not just mean I know that God exists. It means something which is probably much more profound. There's a verse which is quoted, and we're going to see, this is the very end of Masechet Ta'anit. It quotes a verse in Yeshayahu. V'yomer b'yomahu, and on that day, and that's the day that we're waiting for, and that therefore it's not a coincidence that the Gemara of Ta'anit, which talked about fast days in general, and the whole last chapter talked about Tisha B'Av, Shiva Sabatamuz and Tisha B'Av, it quotes a verse and it says, V'nei b'yomahu, on that day, Hinei Elokeinu zeh, Kivinu lo v'yosheinu, right? We've waited for God. Zeh Hashem, Kivinu lo, Nagilu v'nismacha b'yishuato. The Gemara explains, Amar Ula, Bira, Amar Rebbe Elazar, Atir HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lasot Machul Tzadikim. God is going to make this epic dance. V'hu Yoshev B'neihim, and God is going to sit, as it were, in the middle. B'gan Eidim Kol Echad V'Echad Mar Ebe Etzba'o, and everyone is going to point out their finger, Shenemar. V'omar B'yom Ahu, Hine Elokeinu Zeh Kivinu Lo V'Sheinu, Zeh Shem Kivinu Lo Nagila V'Nismacha V'Yeshuato. And that's it. Hadrin Alach, and that's the end of Masechet Ta'anit. Which means it comes out to this day where we'll be able to point out God. And actually, I want to explain this in a slightly deeper way than I've already explained it. And I believe the one who points it out, but I think that the one who actually understands what I'm saying, and maybe I'm reading into it, is going to be the Meshech Chachman 28. And we're going to end with this, but first I want to go back and read the verse one more time. Because there was something in that verse that we hopefully are trained to be sensitive to and understand. What's going to happen on that day? Hinei Elokeinu Zeh. What is the name Elokeinu? It's our God, but nonetheless, it indicates the Midat Hadin. Elokeinu indicates Yein Bayom Hinei Elokeinu Zeh Kivinu Lo V'Yosheinu. And what's our response going to be? Zeh Hashem. It's Yudke Vavke. It's Midat Harachamim. Kivinu Lo. Nagila V'Nismacha B'Yeshuato. That means that somehow the Messianic age is going to include the answer to all of these questions. Which means the Messianic age is not just about a geographical issue that we've moved. It's not just about the Shekhinah returning, but it's the implications of those issues. The implication of the Shekhinah returning is this micromanagement and God manifestation. But it's not just God manifestation, it's closeness to God. Which means if you go back to all the sins that have taken place, they've caused this distance. Which means ultimately we need to get back and cancel that distance and create that closeness and create that intimacy. And again, you go back and you start realizing why all of the sins that we discussed were the ones that destroyed that intimacy with God. But the implication of the Messianic age is not simply having our own free state, and it's not simply having Yom HaTzmaut and saying Hallel in Yom HaTzmaut, all things which I am strongly supportive of. But that's not enough. Which means it's not a contradiction to say Hallel in Yom HaTzmaut, and that's exactly his point, even though he wouldn't have said those, I'm putting words in his mouth, to say Hallel in Yom HaTzmaut on the one hand, but to still have Tisha B'Av on the other hand. And he says the reason for Tisha B'Av, because there's an element of the Messianic age that hasn't been fulfilled yet. And that element is that we're still walking around in our confusion. We're still suffering from some madness. And you know what? We live in a time where there is a profound amount of confusion. Where so many people have so many opinions about so many important things. I mean, we've all, in the last year, have had to struggle with questions. You take an inoculation, you don't take an inoculation. Are you worse getting this thing? Or are you worse by having whatever going to happen after you take? And I could say, yeah, I know what the proper answer to that is, and I know what answer I've advised to people based upon what I think the proper answer, but it does make a difference. Look how much unbelievable confusion takes place. And that's aside from confusion in all kinds of other areas of life. We live in a world with confusion. We live in a world where people can tell you that they're pro-Zionist, but you act in a very anti-Zionist manner. We live in a world of confusion. But it's not just the confusion that we walk around with. It's this confusion of the big issues. And that's really what Rabbi Soloveitchik identified. It's the big issues of walking around still not knowing. And again, you heard him very carefully, what he said very clearly. He said, you don't know why the Holocaust happened, and don't offer your bazooka Joe answer that this was the price that we had to pay in order to get a free state. Because if you think that he said, you saw the words that he used. I mean, he used words like extreme stupidity and worse than that, and cruelty. Because we don't understand why these things happen. But part of the vision of the Messianic age is that God will take us by the hand, and there's going to be music in the background. And not like the music when the second Beit HaMikdash was built, because that was music when there was still confusion. But it's going to be this confusion of this dance that will take place when we're looking and suddenly we get to this realization. One of the things that I skipped is some of the Midrashim draw a direct parallel between that dance in the future and what happens by the splitting of the sea. By the splitting of the sea, we suddenly came to the end of that episode, and actually, it's a Zeh Eli Vanvehu, and it's the same Zeh. They're able to point their finger and say, wow, that God is here, God is with us, and all of our troubles have come to an end. But that's still not exactly the same as what we're seeing right now. That future dance takes place at that moment when suddenly the Midat Hadin gets transferred into Midat HaRachamim, and suddenly all those things that happened through history that we looked and we said, it was painful. And I'm going to admit right now, this is a total leap of faith because I can't understand it. I can't understand how we can possibly reinterpret all the blood that was spilled in Jewish history, going from at least the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, going all the way through the Crusades, pogroms, Khmelnytsky massacres, going leading up into, which metastasized, into a Holocaust, and somehow explaining that all of this was actually God there in the background, and there was somehow something good from it. I don't know how to say that, and that's obscene when the words come out of my mouth, but nonetheless, that's part of the Messianic Age. The Messianic Age is the end of the confusion. The Messianic Age means that there is nothing else that we don't understand. The Messianic Age is when knowledge of God fills up the whole earth, but not just a belief in God, is understanding a God who is kind and good and compassionate. And that's something we can't very easily understand. And that's why most of what I'm saying right now sounds like a complete and absolute leap of faith, but it is, that's why we still need Tisha B'Av. Because Tisha B'Av is when we still have questions. The Messianic Age, and that's part of this belief, that the Messianic Age is going to be this time when all the questions are somehow answered. And that seems like it's a very, very big job to be able to answer all those questions. And that's why it's the Messianic Age. It's just not like, it's not like this, okay, we just need this one more step and everything is okay. No, there's this quantum leap that takes place. And then we suddenly get this perspective. So when God took Moshe by the hand, we have two opinions. Did he explain this to Moshe? Did Moshe now lead the rest of his life understanding this? Or did Moshe also lead his life understanding so many things, you know, more than we can understand, but this one thing evaded him? And again, if this one little thing evaded him and he wanted the answer, and we follow Rav Meir's approach, and this one little thing he didn't know, the problem of why bad things happen to good people, and the problem of Tzadik Viralo, and Moshe didn't know that, so then we realize we don't know it yet either. And there's one more lesson to complete the lesson that God has to give Moshe and that Mashiach has to teach us, and that is still waiting to its completion. But when that takes place, then we're able to have that dance and to point our fingers and to say that, look, all of this was Yudke Vavke, all of this was God. And somehow, this is what was needed to bring us where we are today. So we look forward to that dance, we look forward to that music, and we look forward to that explanation.